Hello and welcome to This Week I Learned, your audio guide to the most surprising discoveries and fascinating studies of the week. I'm your host, Lauren Hansen. This week I learned what it would take to kill all the life on Earth. Admittedly, this sounds quite dreary, but the good news is that life is impressively resilient. It would take such an enormous amount of heat and pressure and such massively cataclysmic events to sterilize Earth that scientists think the chances of such an event happening are slim to none. That's not to say that a giant asteroid couldn't come crashing down and wreak some serious havoc. The aftermath of such an impact, the tsunamis, the earthquakes, the thick fog of dust that would block out the sun, is what would lead to massive crop failure and mass extinction. But the thing is, not all life would be wiped out. In fact, you can just look back to our planet's own history to find an example of such an event. 65 million years ago, the giant asteroid that killed off the dinosaurs wiped out 75% of Earth's species. But lo and behold, 25% survivors mean we have, well, the organism-teeming planet we live on today. You see, life is surprisingly resilient. But how resilient? That's one of the questions that scientists wanted to explore when they discovered what it would take to neuter the planet for good. That means killing even the most resilient and microscopic of Earth's species, the tardigrades. Tardigrades are water-dwelling, eight-legged, segmented microanimals. They're also known as water bears, space bears, or moss piglets for their almost cartoonishly rotund look. These creatures can endure temperatures as cold as negative 272 degrees Celsius, or as hot as 150 degrees Celsius. In a new study published in the journal Nature, scientists examined the effects of three astrophysical events that could conceivably threaten all life: a large asteroid collision, the explosion of a nearby star, and gamma ray bursts. All of these events would be deadly. Gamma ray bursts would eradicate the ozone layer, exposing us to deadly levels of radiation. The star explosion could lead to a complete loss of atmosphere, and the giant asteroid could lead to something called impact winter, where the temperature drops and you get no sunlight for a very, very long period of time. But what's crazy is that in all of these instances, some species will still survive. It's really the deep ocean life that wins out. Even without an atmosphere, the ocean water that remains would form a new atmosphere, and oceans and ocean life would form and live below it. So scientists concluded that really the only way to successfully kill all of life would be death due to heat or radiation. Basically, you have to get to the point where the entire ocean temperature reaches 100 degrees Celsius, or boiling point. You may not be surprised to find that getting the ocean's waters to boil requires a heck of a lot of energy. How much? Well, take the amount of energy the entire human race consumes in a year and multiply that by a million. Or take the energy needed for a space shuttle liftoff and multiply that by a quadrillion. There are only a few objects floating around the solar system that could conceivably create that kind of energy upon impact or explosion. The two largest observed asteroids in our solar system, named Vesta and Pallas, have the right amount of mass for that kind of destruction. And the most massive of the dwarf planets, Eris and Pluto, would also be two other good contenders with the sufficient amount of mass. But scientists note that their estimate is likely conservative, so it would probably take the biggest of these to get to that boiling point, if at all. Which is why it's highly unlikely that such an event will ever happen. Sure, those asteroids and planetary weapons exist, but they're not even headed in our direction. And for a star explosion to do that kind of damage, it would have to happen right next door, cosmically speaking, that would be 0.13 light years away, or about 30 times closer to our solar system than the closest supernova candidate even exists right now. And as for that atmosphere-stripping gamma ray, there's almost zero chance that gamma ray bursts would get close enough to zap our seas right out of existence. In short, it's pretty hard to sterilize the planet. So rest easy. This week I learned that Jane Austen was an avid home brewer, and actually for centuries, brewing beer was relegated to the ladies. In ancient Egypt, women brewed beer to earn some extra cash. In Greece, beer was considered effeminate, wine was the manly drink, and so it was made and consumed by women. In fact, it was a Benedictine nun named Hildegard von Bingen whose writings in the early 12th century on natural history and the medicinal uses of plants, animals, and trees contains the earliest known reference to the benefits of using hops in beer. Up until the 18th century, brewing beer was a woman's game across Europe, too, primarily in England, Germany, and the Netherlands. In newly colonized America, women were also the family brewers, crafting new flavors from ingredients like corn, pumpkin, artichokes, molasses, oats, and honey. The fact is, there just weren't that many beverage choices around at this time. Soda certainly didn't exist, and coffee and tea either hadn't yet been invented, or at least wasn't widespread. Juice would have been too expensive, milk was regarded as unhealthy for adults, and water was often contaminated and couldn't be drunk. So beer was really one of the few safe and affordable options for a household to consume. People had begun to realize that there was something about the boiling and fermenting process of beer that made those who drank it less sick than those who drank water. So it became a household staple, and as such, it was the woman's job to make it for the family. According to Mental Floss, light beer with low alcohol content became a dinner staple for children and adults alike. It provided nutrition for the family, and anything that was left over was usually sold. Through the 15th, 16th, and 17th centuries, beer brewing did start to break out of the home to become a more specialized cottage industry run by men, but women continued to be the lead home brewers until the end of the 18th century. And Jane Austen, well, Jane grew up on a farm, and as an adult, she was intimately involved with housekeeping and food prep of all kinds. And Jane's family was filled with enthusiastic home brewers. One of Jane's specialties was spruce beer, a cousin of root beer that was made with hops and molasses. And the keen-eyed Jane Austen reader may have picked up on her love of brewing from her books. In her 1815 book Emma, Emma and her friend Harriet recall a conversation with Harriet's crush Mr. Knightley, who had wanted to write down some tips for brewing spruce beer. Sadly, women were eventually shut out of brewing. Social and economic changes gradually kicked beer officially out of the home and into the factories where it was made and largely consumed by men. This week I learned that most of your DNA is junk, as in useless, without function. But this, it turns out, is a good thing. Biologists have spent 20 years or more arguing that most of the human genome had to have some kind of function. Researchers first discovered how DNA worked in the 1950s, how these molecular strands encode the instructions for making proteins. And back then, they just assumed that almost all DNA did this. But by the 1970s, it was becoming clear that it was only a fraction of a genome that had the ability to encode functional proteins. But some biologists vehemently disagreed. In the 2000s, another paper was released basically claiming the opposite, that it wasn't a fraction of the genome that was useful, it was the majority. As much as 80% of human DNA has a function, this group of scientists claimed. The issue between the two factions really came down to how they each defined functional. The 80% crowd claimed that if DNA showed any biochemical activity whatsoever, it was functional. But the fraction crowd argued that a sequence can only be described as functional if it had evolved to have a meaningful use. And how researchers define meaningful is where things start to get interesting. You see, human DNA contains gene mutations. These are permanent alterations in the DNA sequence that makes up a gene. Mutations can affect a single gene or even groups of genes. And mutations are either inherited or they occur at some point during a person's life, either from environmental factors like UV radiation from the sun or during cell division when DNA copies itself and makes a mistake. When these mutations happen in important sequences, they are more likely to become harmful than beneficial. And when we have kids, some of our DNA mutations are passed on. Kids with a collection of particularly bad mutations are more likely to die before having children of their own. This is evolution's way of ensuring that those bad mutations aren't passed on. It's also why today most disease-causing gene mutations are uncommon in the general public. And this is how evolution stops bad mutations building up to dangerously high levels in species. And this is where the researchers' logic came in. If most of our DNA were functional, we would accumulate a large portion of harmful mutations in very important sequences. It's just a matter of math. To test this majority functionality theory, researchers from the University of Houston calculated how many children a couple would need to conceive so that evolution could still weed out enough bad mutations from our genomes. And it's a lot. If an entire genome were functional, couples would need to have around 100 million children, and almost all of them would have to die. This, of course, is absurd, but let's say that even a quarter of our genome was functional. Each couple would still have to have an average of 4 children, with only 2 surviving into adulthood to prevent harmful mutations building up into these dangerous levels. Luckily, this is not the case. Researchers estimate that only 8 to 14% of our DNA is functional. The rest is the useless, non-coding DNA. And this is why the majority of those DNA mutations that happen in the course of our lives have no effect, which allows us to have just a few children and a mostly fine genetic health. This week I learned that washing yourself can not only clean the body, but also the mind. Researchers out of the University of Toronto found that the physicality of cleaning one's hands can help shift one's goal pursuits. Basically, clearing your mind of older ideas to make room for new ones. Researchers conducted a series of experiments where volunteers were primed to think about certain personal goals. They were presented with subtle clues through word games or short surveys, and this would encourage them to think about something like being healthy, for example. And then the group was split into 2. One group was asked to look at and evaluate a hand wipe. The other group was asked to use the hand wipe. And those who used the hand wipe became less likely to think about the primed goal, less likely to make behavioral choices consistent with that goal, and less likely to find that goal important. So in the health goal example, after the volunteers were directed to think about being healthy and then either used or didn't use the hand wipe, they were then offered either a chocolate bar or a granola bar. And the ones who had wiped their hands were more likely to go for chocolate than those who had just thought about the hand wipe. Now, that's kind of a negative example, but the plus side to the hand washers was that after shifting away from the old goal, they could better hold on to new ideas and new goals, suggesting better singular focus after washing. Now, the study only focused on short-term thinking, but researchers suggest that washing can clear the brain of old ideas, both the good and the bad. And knowing this gives you the potential power to use it to your advantage. So if you have writer's block, or you're distracted by a bad memory, or you can't make a decision, try taking a shower to wash away the clutter and change your way of thinking. And that does it for this episode of This Week I Learned. Look out for new episodes every Friday on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. To read more about any of the facts I've mentioned, you can go to theweek.com/podcasts, where you'll also find our 7-Minute Opinions and 7-Minute Explainers series. And as a thank you for listening to this episode, we'd like to offer you 4 risk-free issues of The Week magazine. To get started, visit theweek.com/forfree. I'm Lauren Hansen, and thank you so much for listening.